It was the freshest thing you ever heard. The minute Zoot hit one note, I mean, it just went right through your body.
Anyone you talk to, especially saxophonists, will tell you that Zoot had the best time on the planet. He was just the swingingest saxophone player ever.
You know, Zoot was a very colorful, charismatic presence on the bandstand. As soon as he began to play, everything woke up. But it wasn't a matter of posture. It was the sheer force of his music.
Mention the name Zoot Sims to anyone who has heard him play or played alongside him, and you're bound to be greeted with a smile. No musician took more joy in playing than Zoot did, nor has anyone communicated that joy more passionately. He really played from the heart, and at the heart of everything he played was one thing, that wonderful thing called swing. I'm Nancy Wilson. This time on Jazz Profiles, we pay tribute to one of the most admired, most natural jazz musicians ever, tenor saxophonist Zoot Sims.
Rhythm is at the heart of jazz. It's really what jazz is all about and what makes it different from any other kind of music.
Author of Jazz Matters and Zoot's close friend, Doug Ramsey.
The consistent application of rhythmic values in certain ways in jazz. And I don't think anybody personifies that any more than Zoot did. That's what people mean when they say he swang so hard or he swung so hard.
Tenor saxophonist Harry Allen is one of the countless musicians influenced by Zoot Sims.
No matter what he played, it was perfectly in time, exactly where you'd want to put it if you were making your own perfect saxophone player up in your head. That's where you'd put the notes, and he managed to do that without fail.
He was the best jazz musician I ever stood next to in my life, and I stood next to a lot of wonderful ones.
Actually, as a pianist, Dave Frischberg normally sat next to the jazz greats he worked with, including Ben Webster, Bobby Hackett, and during most of the 1960s, Zoot Sims.
His matchless fluency on the horn, I never heard anybody play so fluently. I'm not talking about playing fast, I'm talking about playing coherently. With an innate composition going on all the time, Zoot couldn't help it. He never played anything stale.
Saxophonist and arranger Bill Holman began working with Zoot in the early 1950s.
It was always original. As much as he loved Lester Young, I never heard him once play Lester Young figure that I could identify. It was always just him hearing this music and letting it out, living it.
Valve trombonist Bob Brookmeyer worked with Zoot in a number of different bands.
He really lived to play, you know. Music was everything. When he began to play, it was just an extension of him breathing. He was one of the most organic people I've ever met, as far as music goes.
Zoot Sims was an honest, earthy man whose warm tone and captivating solos on the saxophone were hard to resist. He translated the language of jazz legends Lester Young and Ben Webster into his own very personal style. And when Zoot played, It was as if he were speaking directly to you. His rise to prominence came with the Woody Herman Band, but Zoot could energize any situation. No matter where, when, or under what circumstances, he was always swinging. Doug Ramsey.
I remember a concert on a riverboat in New Orleans in 1969, when Zoot, who was still in his heavy drinking days, had been doing some heavy drinking. And he was leaning against a post in the room on the boat, and he began to gradually slide down this post and ended up sitting on the floor with his eyes closed, swinging as hard as he had been the whole evening. That was Zoot. He was just a natural, indefatigable player.
And he was a whole lot of fun to be around. That is, once you broke the ice. Zoot's widow, Louise Sims.
He was so beloved by all the guys and everybody who got to know him. He at first would give the impression that he was cold or remote or sometimes angry, and that wasn't it at all. He was really inside, rather shy.
Bill Holman was a bit shy himself, and at first he was intimidated by Zoot. But once the two met, a lifelong friendship followed.
Lester Young has a classic solo on a piece called You Can Depend on Me, an old Basie thing. And Zoot made lyrics to that. Said, my name is Zooty Sims. I play the saxophone. Hello. Hello, everybody. Hello. He was so full of life, you know, and always on.
Before he played the saxophone and before he became Zoot, he was born John Haley Sims, the youngest of seven children, on October 29, 1925, in the Los Angeles suburb of Inglewood.
He and his family were about as poor as any California family you can think of.
Again, Louise Sims.
His mother and father had been in vaudeville and had started off in the area of Arkansas, Mississippi, where they were both from, and started working their way across country. They got married, and they started having children. So the first child was born in Arkansas, the second one was born in Missouri, then Kansas, then Texas, and Zoot was the last one born in Los Angeles. But they had a wonderful time. Three of the oldest kids were in the vaudeville act with their parents. They learned how to tap dance and do the clog dancing and singing, playing ukulele and banjo and harmonica.
Zoot Sims.
I thought California, you know, when I look back at it, I think it was great then. A lot of open spaces. You could go to the beach and still see the mountains, the snow on the mountain. And I had a great childhood, so Huckleberry Finn, you know. I went to school barefooted, but luckily it wasn't that cold there.
And one time he went in a shirt that was a hand-down from one of his older brothers, and it had a big rip in the back, which his mother hadn't spotted. And he got into a fight because the kids kidded him about that. So he said his two older brothers always were there to protect him in case things got out of hand, but they never interfered. They let him slug his way through all these battles.
Zoot was swinging even before he picked up the saxophone. But first, he learned to play the only instrument left in the Sims household, a bent clarinet. Since music was the family business, it wasn't long before Zoot got into the act.
We used to move a lot out there, and we hated to move kids because you had to go to a different school, meet new kids. And they came around asking for volunteers for the band. And so my two older brothers next to me said yes, so I always just said yes. And that's how it all started in that grade school.
Zoot was introduced to jazz through his brother's record collection. By the time he was 13, he fell under the spell of tenor saxophonist Ben Webster and Lester Young and switched from clarinet to tenor. Two 2 years later, he was touring in the big bands of Ken Baker and Bobby Sherwood. That's when John became Zoot, and the nickname stuck. When not on the road, Zoot was developing his style in a less formal setting, on L.A.'s Central Avenue, the West Coast hub of jazz during the 1940s.
We worked on Central Avenue, man. That was a pretty rough place down there. It was just the beginning of the war, you know, a lot of fights, you know, sailors. None of that bothered us, you know. It was just a place where we could make $35 a week and blow all night. When you're young, man, that's great, you know.
I'm Nancy Wilson with a tribute to saxophonist Zoot Sims on NPR's Jazz Profiles. By late 1942, news about the talented young tenor player had reached band leader Benny Goodman, who hired Zoot that year and would become one of his most ardent fans. Goodman rehired Zoot again and again in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli was also in the 70s band.
Look, you say, why did Benny have Zoot in the band? Not because he played well. He'd like Zoot to set him up. You see, so Zoot would start a solo, and all of a sudden, once Zoot got it going, it was going. And then all Benny had to do was ride the crest. That's the way I look at it. Don't Be That Way, the Benny Goodman Septet featuring Zoot Sims. After service in the Army and his second tour with Goodman, Sims joined Woody Herman's famed Second Herd in 1947. The band featured a saxophone section without the traditional lead alto player. Instead, there were four tenors, or three tenors and a baritone, played by Zoot, Stan Getz, Herbie Stewart, and Serge Chaloff. It was a refreshing new sound, and when saxophonist Jimmy Giuffre wrote a composition called Four Brothers, the sound had a name. Saxophonist, arranger, and bandleader Bill Holman.
The Four Brothers thing, you know, was really thrilling to hear a section play like that. You take four notes of the chord and give each note to a horn player, and that's it. Like a thickened solo line.
The idea of using four tenor saxophones was actually introduced by trumpeter and arranger Gene Roland before the formation of Herman's Second Herd. Roland was playing with Zoot, Getz, Stewart, and Giuffre at a place called Pontrelli's Ballroom in Los Angeles. Pontrelli's catered to a mostly Latino clientele who liked to dance. Zoot Sims.
We had our own arrangements, but we had to play a lot of stocks, Mexican style music. You know, so they could do their thing on the floor. And we just slipped one or two of ours in there once in a while. it was kind of a nice for us, you know, to get that sound going.
After hearing Zoot and Company one night at Pontrelli's, Woody Herman, who was in the process of reforming his band, decided that was the sound he wanted, and those were the players he needed. Saxophonist Bill Holman.
And then Jufri came up with Four Brothers, you know, which knocked everybody out, which is, by the way, a perfect example of how to make a 3-minute jazz arrangement. You know, the form of that was just beautiful. But that's when it all exploded then.
Four Brothers, recorded by the Woody Herman Band in 1947, with solos in order by Zoot, Serge Chaloff, Herbie Stewart, and Stan Getz. Zoot had a great time in the Herman Band, which was known for its humor, excitement, and intense musicianship. The band brought him wider recognition as well. But as Doug Ramsey explains, that was inevitable.
It was an important credential to have had, but I'm not so sure that it was the making of Zoot Sims. I think Zoot would have had a successful career under any circumstances. And he really wasn't with that band all that long.
In fact, Zoot left Woody in 1949 and landed in New York City, where he also landed on some rough financial times. But Zoot never stopped playing. He got together almost every night with friends like baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan, bassist Red Mitchell, and pianist George Wallington. They pooled their resources, rented out studios, and just blew. And when it came to jam sessions, nobody blew like Zoot did. Guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli.
Zoot played from 3 in the afternoon till 2 in the morning without stopping. His lip was bleeding. But he loved that kind of environment.
And what he loved most about it was being surprised, especially by himself.
The whole joy of jazz is really not knowing what's coming next until it comes.
Sunday, Zoot Sims jamming with saxophonist Benny Carter and trumpeters Roy Eldridge and Clark Terry during a Jazz at the Philharmonic jam session. After making a few of his own albums and freelancing with Miles Davis, Buddy Rich, and others, Zoot found steady work in 1953 when he joined the Stan Kenton Orchestra. Bill Holman wrote arrangements for Kenton and played with Zoot in the saxophone section.
Well, musically, I think it was kind of a stone around his neck. It was an impressive band, you know, but it wasn't really a fun band, so we had a lot of fun in the daytime.
With its heavy emphasis on arrangements, the Kenton Band didn't allow much room for stretching out on solos. Zoot could handle that. What he couldn't handle was the band's European tour later that year.
That's the hardest trip I've ever made in my life, especially in Germany. Like, we'd play one town and get back in a bus, have a warm beer and a sandwich, and go to another town and play another concert. And never sleep, man. I mean, the whole tour was like that.
Shortly after the tour ended, so did Zoot's tenure with Kenton. It happened after the band bus had an accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
The whole trombone section had been lying down in their seats, so they just flew forward and hit the seat in front of them, usually with their mouths, so they were wiped out.
A new trombone section was contacted, and they arrived the next day.
So you call a rehearsal, and we're not over this trip yet. I thought that he could have done it without the sax, because the saxophone players are all right, you know.
So it says, well, we know our parts, why do we have to rehearse? Why don't you just rehearse them? And Stan said, because I want the whole band there, Jack. He didn't call him Zoot very often, he called him Jack. Zoot says, why? And Stan said, because I said so, you know, and then it deteriorated from that.
I was bitching or something. He said, anybody wants to leave, just hold up your hands. I just held my hands. And I was ready anyway. That's when I went back to California. First thing I did was dig a garden, just to get away from it.
From 1953, the Stan Kenton Orchestra featuring Zoot Sims on Crazy Rhythm. Just ahead, Zoot rediscovers the joys of the small group and later forms one of the most celebrated two-tenor teams in jazz. I'm Nancy Wilson with a tribute to saxophonist Zoot Sims on Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio. By the time Zoot Sims left the Stan Kenton Band, he was widely recognized as a leader on his instrument, part of an exciting new breed of tenor saxophonists who were steeped in the tradition of Lester Young. Considering his reputation, work in California should have been easy to find. It wasn't, at least not the kind of work that required a saxophone.
I painted houses for a while in L.A. I had rent to pay, but those things don't bother me. You know, I still play it at night. One thing about painting houses, you got plenty of time to think.
Saxophonist and arranger Bill Holman.
He wasn't a star. He was a player that loved playing, and he knew he could do it well. And if he had to make a living doing something else, he'd do that. He wouldn't be bitter about it, which is amazing. I could do it, but I'd be bitter about it.
That didn't last long. Mulligan saved me, got me out of that. I didn't even have a phone out there. But he got me, and he came to town, and we went down to San Diego, played a school down there, and it's recorded. ¶¶
Baritone saxophonist and arranger Jerry Mulligan had already caused quite a stir with his pianoless quartet. With Zoot, he expanded the group into a sextet, including trombonist Bob Brookmeyer, who occasionally doubled on piano.
Well, I didn't play all that much piano. Jerry liked to play piano, and I played some. The sextet was Jerry's favorite group. The improvisation was just fantastic. Of course, Zoot and Jerry were connected by bone.
Red Door, composed by Zoot Sims and Jerry Mulligan, recorded at Hoover High School in San Diego, California. After 2 years with the sextet, Zoot returned to leading his own small groups, mostly on recording sessions, of which there were many. In 1956 alone, Zoot made 10 albums as a leader for a half dozen record labels. The Man I Love, from the 1956 album simply titled Zoot. A few years later, Sims once again teamed up with Jerry Mulligan to play in his concert band, which made a celebrated European tour in 1960. Author, Doug Ramsey.
You know, that was really one of the great big bands, and it's almost not remembered. But Zoot was a very important part of that band. He was the featured soloist on this European tour, and he really lived up to that billing.
One of the highlights was Zoot solo on a Jerry Mulligan composition called Apple Core, later released on an album.
Zoot plays as passionately on that piece as anything I've ever heard him do. So it was just one of those extremely rare and fortunate instances in which there happened to be recording equipment present when a player was at his absolute peak. I've never heard him play anything like it. Thank you.
The Mulligan Concert Band, featuring Zoot Sims in Zurich, 1960. Zoot's positive attitude and ability to energize any musical setting made him the perfect team player. It accounts for his long-standing engagements with Mulligan and Benny Goodman. But it was Zoot's partnership with fellow tenor saxophonist Al Cohn that would represent the winningest team of his career. The two formed a close friendship back in 1948 when Al replaced Herbie Stewart in the Herman Band. In 1957, they decided to form a group. Guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli.
Well, they made the best tenor duets of anybody in the business, for my money. And what Zoot did, Al loved, and what Al did, Zoot loved. And everybody loved it.
Doug Ramsey.
They had the same view of music. The joy and pleasure they took in making music transmitted itself to people who heard it, and they became extremely popular, as jazz groups go, and were inseparable in a lot of people's minds. Al and Zoot, Zoot and Al.
When I first joined the band, if I closed my eyes, I wasn't even sure who was playing.
Pianist Dave Frischberg was hired by Zoot and Al in 1963.
And of course, it became evident to me later that they each had their own signature sound and way of playing, but they were so tuned into each other and tuned into this refined jazz that they had distilled themselves. It was the two of them, I think, that almost defined the kind of music that they played. To me, it was the logical evolution of what happened to Lester Young's vision of jazz.
Although Zoot Sims and Al Cohn were both disciples of Lester Young, at first glance, their partnership might have seemed an unlikely one.
You know, Al Cohn was a very profound and erudite musician, and you could hear Al's mind clicking as the changes went by. Zoot, on the other hand, I was never really quite sure that Zoot knew the names of the chords he was playing with. He knew the names of the notes, and he was a reader, I know that. But I don't think he approached music analytically the way Al Cohn did. Zoot just swooped down on the music and let his ear take him into this beautiful paradise that he had heard.
For nearly a decade and a half, Zoot and Al were regular attractions at the Half Note in New York City.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Half Note. On tenors tonight, we have Al Cohn and Zoot Sims. They'll start with Lover, Come Back to Me.
The Half Note had a fun, carefree atmosphere, and the music was nonstop, at least when Zoot had his way. Dave Frischberg.
They both were heavy drinkers, but their playing didn't suffer that much, especially Zoot's. at the end of the evening, the place would be empty, and Turk Morrow would come in, or Phil Woods, or somebody would walk in with a horn, and we'll get up on the stand, and that would be fuel for Zoot. He'd want to get up and play now. And everybody had gone, and the place was ready to close up, and Zoot was just wailing. We felt sheepish about stopping.
Zoot Sims, live at the Half Note. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to a tribute to saxophonist Zoot Sims on NPR's Jazz Profiles. Few players in the history of jazz were as unaffected by musical trends as was Zoot Sims. Though he appreciated the innovations of saxophonist Charlie Parker and John Coltrane, Zoot had his own muse to follow, and he could be stubborn about following it. Zoot's widow, Louise, and guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli.
I remember Bucky once saying that something was going on that Zoot didn't like. He let it out on his horn.
He'd honk at me.
At Bucky.
Yeah, he'd look at me and honk. I just got my 7-string guitar, and I was doing a lot of experimenting. Sometimes I would wiggle around, you know, and by that time Zoot gave up, and he'd turn around and give me a big honk on a horn. Zoot's great number was Come Rain or Come Shine, and we used to play it. And one night, the bass player brought in a set of chord changes that Bill Evans wrote, you know, had used. And we played those, and Zoot turned around and says, "Where'd you get those chords from? Don't, I don't want to hear that anymore. I want the regular ones that we were playing." Oh, he couldn't stand it.
Though he was undeniably a traditionalist, Zoot was also an explorer. He felt the opportunities to make new statements with a traditional approach were endless, and Zoot never played the same song the same way twice. But he did have a habit of playing the same songs. That is, until he started working with pianist Jimmy Rolls. Saxophonist Bill Holman.
Jim introduced Zoot to this whole world of songs that, you know, Zoot had been playing bebop tunes and a few of the typical jazz standards all his life, and here's Rolls took it on himself to remake Zoot. And Zoot loved it, you know, he loved those songs.
Along with expanding his repertoire, Jimmy Rolls brought out the lyricism in Zoot with his sensitive accompaniment on piano. Indeed, as hard as Zoot could swing, he could be just as sentimental.
He was the best ballad player I ever heard. And it was no artifice about what he did. He really plumbed the sentiment out of that music.
Dave Frischberg.
And there was a great sweetness and tenderness and depth of emotion. It was the kind of emotion that jazz musicians like to hide.
Body and Soul, Zoot Sims and Jimmy Rolls, recorded in 1978. Zoot wasn't afraid to reveal his emotional side when he played ballads. But as saxophonist Harry Allen explains, neither did he forsake his inherent sense of swing.
A lot of rhythm section players don't think this way. You know, they think, oh, you're swinging on the up-tempo things, but then you're supposed to lay back on the ballads. Well, that's not true. The ballads have to swing too, just a lot slower, and you can't lay back on them, and Zoot never did. Again, the two things that made him a great ballad player were his sound, because he had such a gorgeous sound, and his time. Even the ballad swung.
Zoot's tone on the tenor saxophone had gone from a light and airy Lester Young-like sound to a more guttural Ben Webster-ish quality. And as his tenor sound got deeper, in the mid-70s, he began to explore the higher registers of the soprano saxophone. Author Doug Ramsey.
When he picked up the soprano, he played it just like he played the tenor, with no preconception of how it should sound. He didn't try to sound like Bache, he didn't try to sound like Coltrane, he didn't try to sound like Steve Lacy. He just poured Zoot into the soprano saxophone, played it absolutely in tune from the very beginning, which is a challenge for that instrument, and played it beautifully.
Throughout his career, Zoot Sims had been a heavy drinker. The many stories about his having a little too much fun on the bandstand are almost legendary. But by the early 1980s, that lifestyle had begun to take its toll. Bob Brookmeyer shared the same affliction before he got sober.
I held alcohol very well. I could be completely sloshed inside and outside. You would hire me to be a banker. Zoot showed it. You know, he enjoyed drinking. He didn't try to hide it. As far as Zoot being, quote, an alcoholic, I don't know. When they moved to Tarrytown, he and Louise, Zoot was out gardening and not drinking.
Zoot's decision to quit drinking was a result of a trip to the doctor, prompted by liver problems. Louise Sims.
And the doctor scared him, and he said, you know, I'm glad you're having such a wonderful time playing and living, but if you continue this, you're not going to play and live. Your liver is bad, etc. And so Zoot took him seriously for the first time, and he quit drinking. It didn't last very long, but the time that it lasted did some healing and some repair, and he was beginning to feel better and stronger. Just when he was beginning to feel great again, he learned he had cancer. It wasn't very long after that from being diagnosed that he was gone.
The jazz world said goodbye to one of its most beloved figures on March 23rd, 1985. But Zoot didn't say his goodbyes without a fight. He battled his rapidly advancing cancer the only way he knew how, with his saxophone, playing gigs up until the very end.
Of course, you know, after the gig, he would be totally exhausted, and I'd worry that he wasn't going to make it the next day. But it was just a drive. As he said in an interview with Red Mitchell, just in the last couple of months before he died, Red says, "What are you going to do now?" And Zoot says, "If I can't play, what can I do?" And that was his philosophy. If he couldn't play, he was ready to go.
John Haley Sims lived to play, and when he couldn't play, he couldn't live. That's how deeply Zoot Sims felt about this music we call jazz. And though he is no longer with us, the legacy he left behind serves as a constant reminder of what jazz is really all about: joy, honesty, and that wonderful thing called swing. Our tribute to Zoot Sims was written and produced by Paul Conley. Engineering assistance from Leo Dell'Aguila. Special thanks to Kirill Wheeler at NPR's New York Bureau, our Los Angeles Bureau, and to Fred Bork and Dave Glasser of NPR's Jazz Alive. Thanks also to Angela Cervoni, Carver Barney, Steve Milne, and Gary Vercelli of member station KXJZ Sacramento. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. Administrative assistant, Linda Brolin. Our website coordinator is John Murph. The vice president of NPR's cultural programming is Murray Horwitz. To email us, or for more information on Jazz Profiles, visit NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org, or check us out at nprjazz.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, arts, and culture. Additional support has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.